Follow me down this deep, dark hole.
Hello, and welcome to New Horror Express, your weekly podcast chatting to the best indie talent the horror genre has to offer. I'm your host, Scott Murphy, and on today's episode, I'm chatting to writer-director Rocco Zevenbergen about his debut feature, I Need You Dead, a movie that starts out as a fun 80s throwback picture but it quickly becomes something much darker and surreal indeed. Although to say any more than that would spoil it, so I will not. Over the course of the interview, Rocco tells me about how with this film he wanted to do more than just emulate the movies he loves, the personal place this film comes from, and how the project came together, including the crowdfunding campaign he did for it. Plus, we get into how he hooked up with Troma, how it's better to leave some narrative mysteries in a film rather than over-explain, and how the worst thing a film can be is boring. All of which, and much, much more, you can hear right now in my interview with Rocco. Hi, Rocco. Welcome to New Horror Express.
Thank you for having me, Scott. Happy to be here.
It's good to have you on the show. So, we've got you on the show today to talk about your film, I Need You Dead. So yes. First of all, for the audience, can you give a brief spoiler-free synopsis of I Need You Dead?
Yes. I Need You Dead is about a young punk named Dude who, after a moment of total teenage angst, manifests a psychedelic existential creature of his own creation that he must somehow rid of because it's kind of ruining his life. So that's kind of the setup.
Yeah. And so where did the initial concept for you both wrote and direct the film? Where did the initial concept come from? Where did the initial idea come from?
Well, I was very depressed around the time that I started writing this movie, and ultimately my whole video making career up to that point, I guess you could say, I had kind of just been wanting to emulate the things that I had been seeing all through my life and do my own cheap version of it. And I had a lot of fun doing that and I learned a lot. But ultimately, when I was depressed and I wanted to do a feature for the first time, it started to become more and more clear to me that if I was going to be able to make something that's, you know, almost 2 hours long, actually engaging, it was going to need to come from the heart, and it was going to need to have material that I felt uncomfortable putting on screen. If it was going to really be worth pouring that much money and time into, it had to mean something more to me than just being a cheap ripoff or a fun ripoff, you know, of the stuff that I grew up enjoying. So I decided to make a movie about how I was feeling at that time. And I decided to kind of manifest my depression into kind of like a practical creature effect puppet to keep, you know, homaging back to all the stuff that I grew up loving, but with kind of a darker twist.
Yeah, for sure. And when was this? You know, how long was it? Did it take for the script to come together? And then how long from kind of script until, you know, you were into production? What was that journey?
Right. Yeah. So I started writing the script, I think in probably 2017, and it was all right. I was just kind of throwing paint at the wall, hoping something would work. A few things stuck. A lot of stuff didn't. I ended up going to New York City to work on Lloyd Kaufman's newest film called Shakespeare's Shitstorm. And while I was out there, I got really inspired and really started like taking the script a lot more seriously. Just having then been on a feature film set, I was like, oh, if I'm going to do this, it's got to be really solid. I can't just come up with some fun, goofy ideas here and there. It's got to be a structurally sound story. So I started taking a whole new approach. I threw away all the pages I had written over the past year, and I started from scratch again. And that script, as it slowly developed more and more, became the one that we actually shot with, which we ended up shooting about a year later in 2018. Or was it 2019? Oh, God. Yeah, 2018, I'm pretty sure, is when we shot this movie. And then we did, reshoots in 2019, and then it came out in 2020. We shot it in 2019 in the spring. So I finished the script in 2018, and we shot it in the spring of 2019. Sorry, I'm kind of insane, but it's all good.
That's all good. We're all a little insane. That's fine.
Yeah.
So like you were saying, like there was a shoot in 2019, and then there were some reshoots. So how long was the shoot in total between the initial shoot and the reshoot? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, principal photography was a month. It was about a month of just like 14-hour days every day. We had a budget of about $20,000 when we were actually shooting the film, which I primarily raised just working minimum wage jobs and doing like fundraisers. And we do like house party, like with like bands playing in the basement and raise money that way. And yeah, I mean, it was about a month. It was extremely laborious, but one of the best months of my life, obviously. And then a lot of time went by me cutting together principal photography until I had a rough cut of the film and we sat down and watched it. And we were like, oh man, a lot has to change and a lot of this has to be reshot, including the ending, which we actually scrapped entirely and rewrote and reshot. So it was like we shot that in spring, and I think it was in fall that we actually went into reshoots of that same year, and then we premiered it in March 2020.
And so what was it about the original ending that wasn't working?
Well, it's funny. It's the film has a lot. The film is very complex and has a lot of layers beyond what the audience expects when they go into the film. And the original ending kind of like explained everything to the audience in a strange way. Kind of like if you watched, you know, I don't want to compare our film to this, but I'm just going to do it for the example. It's kind of like if you watched Eraserhead or something, and then the last 30 minutes, David Lynch just like walked on screen and explained what everything meant. It would kind of like ruin the experience, you know what I mean? And just be like, okay, well, that's stupid. So that's kind of, it wasn't that on the nose, but it basically acted as that at the end of the film. And I was like, man, this just takes away all the magic of the movie if we do this at the end. So, also it just wasn't very tasteful. It was just stupid. I mean, I'll release it one day, God knows when, maybe if I have some more success in my life and I'm able to laugh at that failure of an ending a little bit more with a little bit more comfortability. But, you know, until then I'm going to hide it. It's a terrible ending, but the new ending we shot is great. I really like it. It's sad. It's tragic. It leaves you guessing. It's good. I like it. Yeah.
I mean, like, sometimes it's not good to kind of over-explain things. I certainly know that as much as it is a masterpiece, that a lot of people don't like that end scene of Psycho, where he kind of explains Norman Bates' psychosis in the hospital, like the doctor and that, you know.
Yeah, I can see the critique of that. I do like, I do love that final shot though, where the skull and his face kind of meld together for a second. That's a great shot.
Yeah.
That always freaked me. I saw that when I was like 12, and I remember that just like shattered me. I was like, could not get that face out of my head. Yeah.
I mean, it's obviously a masterpiece, but that scene is a bit kind of like Do we need that? Probably.
Yeah.
Not, but
yeah, maybe a different monologue would have been better.
Yeah.
That's funny.
Yeah, for sure. So, you know, obviously, I noticed as well, like I was looking into it and I noticed that you did a kind of go get funding campaign through your YouTube channel. Was that for mm-hmm. the reshoots or was that part of the initial budget?
That was the initial budget. We did, yeah. So we did some fundraising. We did, yeah, like a go get funding thing, which I found to be the best platform because they don't take, I don't think they take the least amount of money than any of the other ones. And you don't have to offer rewards, which frankly, that sounded like a nightmare to me. I don't know how filmmakers do that, how they like sell DVDs before the movie's even done. Mm-hmm. I mean, that would just be a cloud.
Oh, so they don't have like a kind of tiering system like Indiegogo or Kickstarter or, you know, whatever.
No, it's just a donation platform. And at the end of the day, and, you know, we post updates on there and stuff like that. But at the end of the day, it's like, as much as I would have loved to have just been like, Venmo me this much money or something. You know what I mean? Like, I probably could have built a website that looked like a little bit more legit for people to send donations. But at the end of the day, I just wanted like a credible looking website for people to donate to. So they felt like they were really donating to the movie and they weren't just like sending me money or something, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So yeah, we did that and that helped. You know, I think we raised, I don't know, like $5,000 or something doing that. So that was, you know, that's a quarter of what we used. So that was helpful. You know, it wasn't like some people raise like $30,000-$50,000 or whatever. I don't know what the hell they're up to, but you know, we got some money out of that.
Cool.
Yeah.
And you know, but like before going into production, like how did the kind of cast come together? Was that through auditions, through people, you know, kind of contacts you knew? Like what was that process?
To get our cast together, I used Backstage, that website Backstage. Really, that's like, have you ever heard of Backstage?
No, but then I suppose I've never cast a film, so.
Yeah, I think it's pretty common place for casting movies. It's kind of like a Facebook for actors almost.
Okay.
And you just, I just basically wrote little, you know, one scene things to send to people and like character bios. And I sent them to everybody on Backstage that kind of like looked the part, just kind of flipping through pictures. And people would get back to me, oh, I want to audition for this and that character, whatever. And then we hosted auditions and had people read sides and then had people come back. You know, we like picked like two for each character that we liked and then had them come back and had them do second auditions and then solidified our cast that way. It was a pretty good process. I really love our cast. I think they all did a really good job and I couldn't see the roles being played by anyone else at this point.
Yeah, cool. And I was wondering, when you were making the film, were you in any way worried about how the audience might react to the film in terms of like, without giving any spoilers, there's after the first half an hour, there's like a significant shift in look and tone mm-hmm. of the movie.
Yeah.
And were you at all concerned that people might not go with that?
Yeah. And that's the funny thing is that shift and turn is an idea that came about halfway into developing the script. And I had that idea and I was like, oh man, this would really piss some people off. I was like, this would really, really piss some people off. And I was like, and that got me so excited because frankly, I'm really sick. And I'm a little over it now, but I used to be really sick of just seeing just 80s like worship and dick sucking. Like everyone's trying to make the next Stranger Things movie thing. I don't know. Like, it's like, yeah, the 80s were great. Let's move on. Let's make some new movies. Let's change things. Let's have our own renaissance now as independent filmmakers. And I wanted to make a movie that at face value kind of looked like one of those movies so that I kind of reel in all these people who are just like caught gobbling all this 80s throwback bullshit. And then when that part happens, it would slap them all in the face. And 50% of them would be like, oh, man, I totally got duked here. But then they're like, oh, but I actually really like this. And whoa, maybe, huh, maybe there's more to a movie like this. Maybe there can be more depth to a movie like this than I thought. And then the other 50% would be like, well, fuck this. This isn't what I wanted. And then, you know, they hate the movie. And that's exactly what's happened. You know, we've had that split reaction where people either hate it and their reason is just, this isn't what I wanted. And the people who love it are like, this isn't what I expected, but this is great. You know, and they dig it. So yeah, I did go into it with that kind of attitude. You know, maybe it makes me kind of an asshole, but I don't really mind.
Fair enough. Yeah, no, I kind of get that. Cause I mean, like it is certainly a swerve and I can see why, you know, some people, but like you say, you know, you're setting up a set of expectations there and you know, like some people will just want that, but some people like to have their expectations kind of subverted. And if you do it in a smart way and you don't, I think it's all right. I think sometimes movies do kind of left turns for the sake of left turns and like, you know, they just I've kind of talked about it on the podcast before. I often feel that there is kind of tonal shifts done in movies that often just don't work that well, and I feel like there is certain types I often feel that it, like Asian filmmakers do it tonal shifts better than like Hollywood filmakers or British filmmakers for some reason. Like Bong Joon-ho and Takeshi Miike and, you know, like filmmakers like that seem to do like left turns all the time, but they make it kind of fit the narrative. And I feel like yours does as well, but it is quite a kind of leap, you know. Because like the first half an hour, the way I was thinking about the first half an hour, it was like kind of, it's kind of in that kind of nostalgia thing. It kind of felt like part Astron 6, part Trauma, part Scott Pilgrim. And that's how I kind of framed it in my head.
Which I love all three of those things. So that's a compliment too. And I love that world of cinema so much. I just think we should build on it more instead of just trying to go back to it, if that makes sense.
Oh, no, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, like, I've seen like a lot of things that, you know, you want to do something different. I think like, you know, you build on things. Like people often, for example, some people really don't like Tarantino, and that's fair enough. You know, like he's kind of one of those directors that can rub people up the wrong way. But the thing that I would say about him is he's a filmmaker who does have his own ideas. He does kind of lots of covers of things, but he doesn't just do covers of things. He does his kind of own spin on those covers, whereas some people are just doing covers.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I agree. And it's like if you're not pissing off a certain amount of your audience personally, I think you're kind of doing it wrong because you're not taking any chances. If there's no chance of something, of people not digging it, then it's just not as exciting to me. I don't know. And that's the thing is, if you know, if people don't respect that we tried to do something different, then I don't really listen to that. I'm like, all right, whatever. You don't really appreciate movies the same way I do. That's a fundamental disagreement. But if people are like, no, I love it when movies do things like this and take risks, and I respect your movie for taking a risk, but I don't, but I didn't like how you did it. Like, I think it could have been done better. Like, it was too jarring, or I would have liked it to have gone in a different direction. Like, that's fine. If people hate the movie, you know, for the way that I decided to do that, then, you know, that's fair. And I want to hear people's critiques out. And you know, it's hard to listen to criticism when you've worked on something for so long, especially this being our first feature film. Mm-hmm. But you know, that's the game you sign up for, baby. Like you got to get ready for that. And so the reviewers who I really have appreciated the most the reviews where people said, I didn't like it, but I respected that they tried to do something different. Those are like my favorite reviews, even more than the ones that just like say we're the best movie ever. Like, I like those kind of mixed ones. We've had some reviews come in where people are just like, you know, these guys suck. They weren't honest to their own feelings when they made this. They weren't committed. They don't know how to make movies, like blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, what is this? Like, you're just projecting your own insecurities onto our movie or something. Like, get out of here. Like, some critics, man, I don't know. They're crazy. They're after people. I don't know.
Like, I mean, I'm a critic myself, you know, like I review films on the website and I review albums for another website. But I mean, like, yeah, I mean, even as a critic myself, I can admit, like, yeah, some critics are mean. And I like to think that I always try to find things that I like about a thing. You know, right. Like, I try to find at least one positive. And as well as that, I am also of that same mindset of, like, I would much rather, like, if I review a film and I decide that the film is, like, 2 stars, for example, it's like a 2-star film, I just, it didn't work for me. I'd rather watch something that is, like, all over the place, that is like, you know, that takes chances, that is occasionally maybe in moments like a 4-star film, but in other moments a 1-star film, and like, you know, it went there, you know, and maybe it didn't work and maybe it's a bit of a mess, but you know, it tried. And I'd rather watch that than something that is just a solid throughout just kind of dull 2-star film of like, yeah, this is just a so-so film. It's like, it's not terrible, it's not good, it's something that you can watch but you will forget almost instantly.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's I really there's nothing I hate more than a movie, like when a movie is boring. That's always, to me, is the most offensive thing a movie can do, is just be boring. And for me, what makes a movie boring, the number one thing, is when you know everything that's going to happen before you even put the damn DVD in. And there are too many movies like that, where it's like, okay, it's got this guy on the cover and this, like, it's, I'm a huge VHS collector. And I used to be much more into buying VHS just based off if the cover was cool or not. And I ended up watching a lot of bad movies, but I started, it got to a certain point where I would look at a cover and I was like, I know exactly what this movie is going to be. Like, there's going to be one scene where we see this image that's on the back cover. That's going to be the best part of the movie. And the rest of it is just going to be talking heads, you know, like blah, 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 blah. Like, and that's the most criminal thing a movie can do, I feel like, is just, it doesn't even have to say anything. And right when you put it in, you already know. It's like this, if there's a spirit to each film. And I feel like within that first like 10 minutes, you can start to get an idea of that this movie is something you've never really handled before. Or if you can kind of just start checking your phone and cooking some food or whatever.
Yeah, I have to say, like, I can very much relate to that experience, you know, as like a kind of horror fan and an action fan. And in my teens and exploitation movies, I would often go into the video shop and pick various videos based on badass looking covers. And yeah, I've watched a lot of terrible movies because a lot of terrible movies have great VHS covers.
Yeah. They do. That's why they do. It's the only thing getting people to watch them.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I also doff my cap to various trailer editors as well, because I think, like, I kind of feel the same about trailers as you were talking about kind of VHS covers, of like, if I watch a trailer for a movie where I'm pretty sure that I have learned everything that I need to know about that movie in 2.5 minutes, I'm like, I probably won't check that out. There's certain trailers that you watch for, say, like a comedy, where you're like, yeah, that's the best gag in the movie. Yeah,
right. Fine. you know right away. Yeah, I mean, we dropped the new trailer for I Need You Dead about 2 weeks ago or so. And it's our first proper trailer. The other trailers we did, we actually filmed additional footage just for the trailers. We didn't use any clips from the film because we didn't want to give anything away. We just kind of wanted to build on the world more and add to the, and just kind of introduce the vibe of the film to people without giving anything away. This new trailer we dropped is a proper trailer, just clips from the film, but we still really don't give anything away, so I'm happy with
it. No, you don't. I've seen the trailers, and you don't give anything too much away. In terms of, you did talk about the kind of creature that Dude manifests. I was kind of wondering, in terms of influences, kind of like, did you have is that the kind of creature you had in mind? The creature that ends up in the film, is that kind of what you had in your head?
You know, nothing is what you have in your head that actually ends up on screen. And yeah, with the creature, I mean, obviously I probably imagined it to be much gnarlier and way scarier looking, and then it ended up being kind of this goofball thing. But I mean, it's just like, I don't know, you know, it's like you have a nightmare or something, you try to explain it to someone and you can't really capture exactly what made it like so horrifying to you when it was happening, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And with the creature, it's kind of a similar thing. It's like, you know, it's what's scary to you is funny to other people. And I kind of just tried to embrace that element of it, of being like, okay, well, yes, depression is sad and scary, but everybody deals with it. And if I take it that seriously, I'm just going to be one of everybody else. So we may as well poke fun at it, make our creature wear sunglasses and have like a New Yorker accent and just kind of go with that vibe instead. And I feel like it worked. You know, it wasn't what I expected, but again, you're never going to know how things are going to turn out. And I'm happy with how it turned out.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. And like, you know, we previously talked about kind of 80s things that kind of, I don't know, like even though it kind of doesn't have eyes, it did kind of remind me of like, you know, something like Basket Case or something like that.
Yeah, Hedenlauer's great. It's funny, I watched his films. It's one of those situations where everybody I talk to is like, oh, you must be a huge Hedenlauer fan. And I'm like, I am, but only after releasing I Need You Dead did I actually come upon his stuff and watch Basket Case.
Really?
And Brain Damage. And
fascinating.
Yeah, no, I hadn't seen his stuff yet. But yeah, the creature does have some Basket Case vibes. Eric Fox, who was on Sci-Fi Channel's special effects show Face Off, have you ever heard of that? He was a contestant on that show, and I met him on the set of Lloyd's new movie, and we kind of buddied up there, and he helped. He actually created the creature puppet for I Need You Dead.
And Lloyd actually cameos in your film. So how did you come to be on Shakespeare's Shitstorm? I saw that from your like YouTube channel and stuff, your short film, the Meat Lovers, was at Trauma Dance. Was that how you first came into contact with Lloyd and Trauma?
Yeah, I met Lloyd as a fan at one point at Comic-Con, and you know, had him sign my Toxie Blu-ray or whatever. And then I visited New York a year later, and you can just go to Trauma HQ. You can just knock on their door. They will give you a tour, show you props from their films, and you can meet Lloyd and Michael Herz. And they're so inclusive. So anybody listening who's ever in New York and just wants to see an independent studio doing their thing, go swing by Trauma. I met Lloyd there, met one of their employees who was putting together Trauma Dance. And I told them, hey, I actually have this short film called Meat Lovers, and I sent it to them, and they got it on the bill. So I ended up coming back to New York for Trauma Dance. And while I was there, Lloyd asked me if I would join the team for Shakespeare's Shitstorm. And of course, I was very enthusiastic and was like, yes, of course. And yeah, we kind of buddied up that way. And, you know, he's been my mentor in many ways since. He's helped support the film and appeared in our fundraising video and cameoed in the film, and has done a lot to help us. So
that's cool. And I was going to ask you as well, like, because I recently interviewed Lloyd, and so were you just there for like the American part of the shoot, or the part where they went to Albania as well?
Yeah, I wasn't in Albania when they shot out there on the boats. That stuff sounded wild, though. I wish I could have been.
And yeah, so like, you know, from all the kind of behind the scenes documentaries on all the trauma films, like many independent films, they're famously kind of tough shoots. Like, what was your experience?
Man, when I was work, I at a certain point when I was making Meat Lovers. Because I had mentioned earlier that a lot of the movies I was making up until I Need You Dead were kind of just homages to the stuff that I liked. And Meat Lovers was kind of the final one, which was my homage to Trauma. And at that time, I was working at a nickel arcade. And on my breaks, the break room was like it was just like a utility closet. We didn't have a break room, but I turned the lights off in there and set my phone up. And I'd watch those Trauma behind the scenes videos and documentaries, and man, they just inspired the fuck out of me. And they made me look out the window constantly daydreaming about just doing that, being a part of that. And I just love how gritty their approach was to it and how it just felt like real life. It's like, yeah, if I was in this situation, these are probably the problems that I would face. You know, not that I can't pay my actor a million, blah, 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 or whatever. But just that it's like, oh, the location told us to fuck off. What are we gonna do? Like, we're just people. We're not a big studio. We're just people. We don't have that kind of power. So that really inspired me. And so to go on to Shakespeare's Shitstorm, you know, I was excited to face those problems. And yeah, we certainly had a fair share of them. Was it of the caliber of like Poultry in Motion, the infamous Trauma documentary about the making of Poltergeist?
Yeah, which
No.
I recently watched again, because like I have like a kind of spin-off series from this series, where it's some me and some of the former guests look at 21st century guilty pleasure horror movies, and Poltergeist was one of them. So I rewatched Poltergeist, I rewatched Poultry in Motion, and yeah, they're all sleeping on the church floor and stuff
Oh,
in this
yeah.
super rough neighborhood in Buffalo, and yeah, it's
Yeah.
crazy.
No, yeah. I mean, and that's the thing is I was ready for that. You know, I was like, all right, let's do it. Like, frankly, I'm a little glad that it wasn't that horrible because maybe I'd have a little more resentment towards Lloyd and the Trauma team had it been that brutal. No,
Yeah,
yeah,
Lloyd
you
did
know.
say that this one was a bit smoother than, certainly much smoother than Poltergeist, but
It
like smoother
was.
than normal as well.
It was. And I honestly think that the release of It Was Smoother on Shitstorm was because a lot of people saw Poultry in Motion and they were ready for that. And so he actually had a crew that was ready for shit to hit the fan. And so it never really did all too much. And also because his wife, Pat, was always on set and she chilled him the fuck out.
Right, okay.
She would not let him get unhinged. Yeah, she was really in charge behind the scenes in a kind of funny way.
Okay, fair enough, bro. And
Yeah.
in terms of the shoot of your own film, I Need You Dead, was there anything in the way of like on-set disasters or anything like that, or was that relatively smooth too?
It was pretty smooth. I mean, it was really strenuous. I mean, we would have days where we would start at 9 in the morning and end at 4 in the morning the next day. And then we got to get up again at 10 or 11, you know, the next morning, whatever. So we had some strenuous days and it was very physically taxing. I mean, I really carried a lot more on my shoulders on that film than I should have. I didn't have really like a proper AD because our AD was also our gaffer doing all the lighting setup. So I had to carry a lot more of just the menial organization communication with our cast and crew more than the average director probably would on a film like this. And there was a certain point where we were like midway through another long shoot day. We had like, you know, 50, 60 extras at this house party scene. And I was laying against the wall and our producer came over to me and I told her, I was like, hey, like I need you to schedule a Zoom care appointment for me or something, because I think I'm coming down with like pneumonia or something. Like I think I'm going out or something, because I was so exhausted and stressed out. Luckily, I ended up being okay and pulled through. I think I just needed food because I hadn't eaten in like 2 days or something. But So it was brutal in that way. But, you know, was there some person who was in a chicken costume for 3 days and they fell in a well or something? Like, no, it wasn't like nothing crazy. You know, I told everybody who was on our crew, like, look, this is going to be really hard. It's going to be long hours. The food is going to suck. Most of you aren't going to get paid. You're doing this because you love film and you want to see through an independent movie in your hometown, and you're going to get your say in, you're going to have an impact on this film, and it's going to be our movie, not my movie. And that incentive, I think, drove people forward and ended up making it a pretty pleasant experience most of the time.
Well, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so you definitely think, like, going forward, you know, like, if you make your next feature, probably do less. Because, I mean, like, at this one, you were writer, director, editor, you did some of the music, you know, like, mm-hmm. you're all, like often with these kind of indie productions, you're all over the credits.
Right. Yeah, I did do some music, and, yeah, I primarily edited, I mean, in terms of cutting it all together, luckily, our director of photography, Brooks Hauser, did a lot of work in the editing room to help me. So there was some aid there. But yeah, I mean, it was pretty brutal. Next time on the next feature, which we're currently working on, I'm splitting my writing duties with Dude, the guy, his name is Esteban Munoz, who plays Dude in I Need You Dead. We're currently co-writing the next feature. And I'm going to have a proper AD on that film for sure.
Did you have, in terms of all your duties on the film, from writing, directing, acting, editing, all that kind of stuff, like, did you have like a kind of least favorite thing and most favorite thing that you did?
Yeah. And actually, can you give me like 30 seconds? I just got to tell somebody who walked in. Most favorite job. I mean, the best part of making movies for me is directing. That's what I do. That's like my strong suit. That's where I feel the most natural at. The least favorite, I mean, editing sucks, man. Editing sucks. But at the same time, I know how to do it pretty well at this point. I have a lot of knowledge around editing. So it's not even something that I feel like I'll probably give up. I feel like I'll always be very heavily involved with it because I have a very distinct style of how I like to cut things together. I'm a drummer outside of making movies, and I've been drumming for, I don't know, like 10 years or something. And so the way that I like to edit I like to consider it very percussive, and I find myself slapping the space bar a lot like it's a drum when I'm cutting things together. So I don't want to lose the fun of that. And I feel like it adds to the style of the stuff I make. So editing sucks, but it's kind of a necessary evil. Directing, that's the best. Getting to be on set and everyone's just looking at you like, all right, what's next? What's next, boss? That's the best. So fun.
Fair enough. Yeah, I can get that. In terms of like you saying like editing sucks, is it mainly the kind of laboriousness of it? Or is it like that kind of trying to be objective and knowing what needs to be cut and what, mm-hmm. you know, what needs to stay, like that kind of thing.
That's my favorite part, actually, is the, oh, what needs to go, what needs to stay? Because that's me being more of a director in the editing room, being just like me focusing on the vision. The thing is 90% of editing is problem solving. It's just like tech issues. Because when you're working on a movie that's this big with this much data, like terabytes of data and film and footage and video and audio, whatever. It's just a lot of technical problem solving. And I'm not a Geek Squad employee. Like, that's not what I do. That's not why I got into movie making, but I may as well be one now. I probably could work there because I've had to solve so much bullshit editing about my computer going haywire. But somehow I'm talking to you on the very computer that edited I Need You Dead. I don't know how this thing survived the first 30 minutes of Saving Private Ryan, which was editing this film. But here we are.
You've got across the finish line. It's all good.
Yeah.
I was wondering as well, in terms of like, you know, you play kind of like a version of yourself in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if you ever, at any point, you worried about people kind of seeing that, identifying that as you, or like, you know, kind of, and just assuming, you know, upon maybe meeting that you know, a kind of a brooding temperamental artist.
That's funny. It's actually funny that you say that, because so post COVID, we continued screening the movie, but we did it drive-in style. We like built our own drive-in outside of our office building. And on one of the nights, somebody rode up and I was like helping direct traffic or something. And one of the people who was coming had already seen the film. They were coming to see it again. And they said, "Hey, I know this, maybe this is kind of a weird question, but you know, did that really happen? Like what's in the film? Like, did that really happen? Or is that like fake? Is that like scripted?" And I was like, "Oh God, like people can see this and think that it's real." Like, I mean, I was hoping there might be a little something like that, but once I saw the completed film, I was kind of like, nobody's going to think that this actually happened. So, I mean, I guess maybe I should be a little worried about people thinking that I'm like this crazy asshole who maybe killed somebody. you know, I mean, look, that's why we're doing these interviews, right? So that people can hear that I'm not, I guess, right?
Yeah, they can hear the real you for sure. Yeah.
All right. Yeah. I mean, of course, there's a part of me, there's a lot of me in that character. And it's that's the thing, is it's like, I think all of us have that kind of evil, unhinged version of ourselves that comes out when we're alone. And the thing is it's like many of the scenes of me just losing my shit, talking about killing myself and stuff. I mean, that all stems from a real place. But the twist is, okay, but what if you brought that energy out into the public with the people that you're working with, and you actually kind of unleashed it on them, in kind of that, you know, when you're kind of in your own head, sometimes you have crazy little fantasies that, and all humans do, of like, you know, when you're driving down the street and you see somebody and you're like, I could just run over them. You know, it's like, that's a very human thing to think, and it's crazy, and you don't do it, and that's what makes us human. But horror movies are about breaking those boundaries down. So to me, it was like, okay, you know, what if in that kind of suicidal, depressive, angry, confused state, I really went out there and unleashed on people? And in a lot of ways, that's kind of part of what happens in this movie. And so it's like, yes, it is kind of coming from a real place, but I'm a human, hopefully a balanced human, and you don't have to be afraid of me.
Yeah. I mean, like, yeah, I mean, I got the sense that it was like a person, you know, a kind of personal film that you were exploring things. But like, I don't know, like maybe just based on our email exchanges, I kind of parsed the two things apart of being like, oh, maybe some of the depression stuff comes from a real place, but assuming that all the stuff where you're a kind of dictator dickhead was right, just like fiction.
Yeah. And you know, it's like, I don't know. It's just, it stems from real feelings, but not real actions. And anyone's feelings are valid as they occur, but actions speak louder than words. And you know, that's what makes a human a human. And everybody's got their dark side. It's just what you decide to do with it. And so for me, making this movie is what I wanted to do with it. And frankly, my life has been a lot more peaceful since I made this movie. And I think by expelling a lot of that anger into that character and into those scenes, I'm living a better life now, which is kind of crazy, but it's true.
Well, that's good. That's good to hear. That's good. Yeah. And like you say, yeah, I mean, like we all have those things. We all have those dark thoughts, and we all have, you know, kind of ugly parts of ourselves. But, you know, like you say, it's the choices that we make that define us and how we deal with those ugly parts.
Right. Exactly.
So I was, you know, you're talking there about like, you know, doing kind of drive-in kind of showings and stuff like that. I was also like, you premiered last March at the Hollywood Theater in Portland, where you are. How did the premiere go? How did that all go?
Oh, it's crazy, man. It was absolutely insane, because literally the day before the premiere, which we had sold out Portland's biggest theater, so we were really excited. We didn't even think we were going to get booked at this theater, let alone sell it out. So super exciting. But the day before, our local governor sent out a notice that the lockdown was starting because of COVID. And the Hollywood contacted me, the Hollywood Theater, and they said, hey, we might not be able to show the movie tomorrow. I'll let you know. If we do, we'll have to postpone it and refund everybody's tickets. And that, I mean, oh my God. I was up all night, my friend. I was destroyed. I was convinced this film was not going to get premiered. And they called me the next morning and they said, all right, we'll show your movie and then we're going to close like tomorrow. Like we're going to kind of like low key show this, let this premiere happen and then it's over. And yeah, our movie, I swear to God, it was the last movie that played in all of Portland, our city. That was it. So we really just fucking, it was the Indiana Jones slide grabs the hat at the last second kind of thing, you know?
Absolutely slid in under the wire. That's exactly. Amazing. That's amazing. Yeah.
So we made it, but then it's like, well, now what? Now, okay, we did our premiere, but we want to keep showing it. So we did the drive-in, which was super fun, and we're gearing up to do it again as the weather's getting better here.
At that time, did you try to apply for any of the kind of virtual festivals that have happened over 2020 and into 2021?
I kind of resented the idea of doing it at first, because I think when COVID hit, all of us were a little bit like, okay, well, we'll just wait it out. All the plans we have, you know, they'll get postponed a month or two and then it'll happen. And it wasn't until, you know, I think 3 or 4 months had gone by that it was like, okay, so this thing's basically just going to be here till it's not. And I just need to start adapting to this world. And I applied to some festivals, but I didn't really have any guidance on that. And I applied to festivals that were coming up really soon. And anybody who's listening to this, take warning. If you're applying to film festivals, apply to the ones that are far away, because those are the ones where they don't have everything already figured out. The ones that you're applying to that are happening in a few weeks, there's no point in applying to those. They've already picked all the films they want. I didn't know that at the time, so I wasted a lot of money on those dumb virtual festivals that nobody probably even attended anyways, and didn't get into like any of them because I didn't know what I was doing. I read a few books and now I know, but yeah, that's learn from that mistake if anyone's listening to that.
Okay. Fair enough. Yeah. You know, I mean, yeah, I know it's a kind of complicated, but you know, having talked to a few people who have got into virtual festivals or have applied for virtual festivals, it's I know it's a complex yeah. Kind of process, and there's a lot of politics involved in that, mm-hmm. in terms of like who gets picked, who doesn't get picked. But yeah. I see that, you know, from your site, that the movie is, you do have like a DVD of the movie that is available, and in the you left a comment under the trailer for the film that you are in contact with a streaming platform, or you've been in talks with a streaming platform about possibly streaming it online. Is that correct?
Yeah, so right now it's on DVD. We only have a few copies left and then we're going to run out. So actually, literally after we finish this interview today, I'm starting my outreach to some distributors, some of which I've already been talking to, some of which I haven't hit up yet. My goal is to get the film on Shudder. That's really what I want. I really hope we can do that. I really think what Shudder is doing is great. Whether we get on Shudder or not, I'm a huge supporter of what they're doing for independent film and independent horror in the streaming world. And I hope more platforms like them start to pop up in the streaming world, because there's definitely a lot of potential there. And so that's my goal. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you know, hopefully the distributor that we land gets us a new run of DVDs out soon and onto a streaming service soon. In the meantime, we have some left, and we're also doing a limited edition VHS run as well that you can pre-order on the website right now.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, just because of your experience on Shakespeare's Shitstorm, I was wondering if you had at any point discussed with Lloyd about like being on Troma Now, you know, because they have their own streaming.
Yeah, Meat Lovers is on Troma Now, and that was fun. just because I got to have a piece of paper that kind of like they sent me a contract with Lloyd and Michael's signature on it that said Meat Lovers was a Trauma thing. And obviously that movie was an homage to Trauma. So as a Trauma fan, that was really like nice and fun to see. And I still have that piece of paper. But with Trauma now, I mean, that's the thing is I don't necessarily want I Need You Dead to be a Trauma film, because I feel like a lot of times with Trauma films, they kind of just become a part of like Lloyd's legacy in a strange way. And I'm kind of trying to start our own thing here with Bad Taste Video. And, you know, ultimately at the end of the day, if we can't land a good DVD distributor that I'm happy with, I will compromise on things to work with Trauma because I want to support them. I love them, what they're doing. I love Lloyd. So there's definitely a potential that we could link up with them. But, you know, with Trauma now, if we end up having to kind of just put the movie on as many platforms as we can, like we don't land an exclusive platform like Shudder, but rather we're okay, get it on Tubi, get it on Amazon, then yeah, we'll put it on Trauma now as well. You know, any way we can link up with them, I'm always going to do that.
And yeah, like you're a big fan of Shudder, and I hope you can land that, and I think that would be pretty cool.
Yeah, we have a little bit of an in with them. We've done a little bit of work for them, shooting some stuff out in Oregon. Unfortunately, I can't talk about it too much because of the contract that we had to sign, but it's going to be really cool. And I'm super excited to talk about it like crazy once it finally happens. We have that in for them since we did a little work for them. So I'm hoping that helps lube the situation a little bit. So we'll see.
And can you, in terms of things you can or cannot talk about, can you talk about the new project that you're working on with Estevan at all, or do you want to just keep that under your hat for the moment?
I mean, I'm happy to talk about it now just because it'll be funny in retrospect if it totally changes, but just to have a document of it somewhere. I'm working on a movie right now called Flapjacks, which is a movie about mommy issues, and it's about a kid who runs kind of this like underground art venue situation, and he's kind of tied up in that, and then suddenly he's called home when his mother announces that somebody in the family has died, and he needs to come home to kind of like help his mother and take care of her a little bit, and their relationship starts to get complicated when she becomes hooked on this pancake style opioid drug called Flapjacks that is being peddled by this kind of big corporation. And she starts to melt. We'll just leave it at that. That's kind of where it's at right now. With looking at where the script is right now and how far away I know we are from shooting it, and looking at where I Need You Dead was when it was at about this phase of the script, I imagine the story may radically change. But that's just kind of, you know, that's a portrait of where we're at right now with the story.
Excellent. Well, I'll be interested to see that whenever that comes out, and to see how closely it resembles the description in this very recording.
Yeah, I'm curious too.
Well, I suppose that just leaves me to say thank you very much, Rocco, for coming on to New Horror Express. It's been great to have you on the show and talk all about I Need You, You're Dead. And I look forward to, you know, catching it again whenever it hits streaming. And I recommend people catch it when it does hit streaming, wherever it hits.
Thank you very much, Scott. I really appreciate you having me on, and I really appreciate you highlighting independent films and filmmakers and taking chances on movies like mine. You doing what you're doing is extremely important. So thank you so much for doing what you do.
Thank you very much for that. Please do come on again anytime, you know. Whenever Flapjacks in whatever form comes out.
Totally. 100%. I'll be here.
That was my guest Rocco there, who I'd like to thank once again for coming on the show. As always, I'd like to thank you, listener, for tuning in to this latest episode of New Horror Express. Remember, If you like what you heard, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. Unfortunately, that is all for this time, but be sure to tune in next time when I will have another great guest from the world of indie horror. Until then, though, see ya!